So remember what we did yesterday, so quantization. Quantization of a non-abelian gauge theory. And I will treat the example of the SU2 theory as a simplest example. So remember, we want to define some big path integral, let us call it Z, which is an integral of all the gauge field configuration of exponential of I times the gauge action. Okay? Pure gauge at that stage. And we have seen that this action is has a very big symmetry group, which is local gauge transformation. Namely that, we have, let us say, a space, I made this drawing. I have a space A, which is a space, a calligraphic A, with a space of gauge potentials. Okay? A. Where A means, in fact, A mu A of X. Okay? Now we have a very big group of symmetry, which is a group of local gauge transformations. So G, and here a G will denote a set of G of X. In the group G equal SU2. Okay? Okay, so this is, this is I. Okay. So the index I goes from 1 to 2. Mu I goes from 1 to 2. Mu goes from 1 to 4. This is a Lorentz index. This is a group fundamental, the fundamental representation index. I will come out, and A goes from 1 to 3 is a adjoint representation. Index. Okay. And performing a gauge transformation means that we transform A into an A of G, which is basically G A G minus 1 plus or minus I G times D of G minus 1. Where this is d mu, and there is an a mu. And these are multiplication of 2 by 2 matrices. OK? And so we have seen that among this big space of gauge orbits, in fact, you have gauge orbits. So there is a foliation of our space by the orbits of G. And we have seen that, of course, both the action and the measure, in fact, the action that's obvious and the measure is taken to be defined as an action that is local and invariant, are gauge invariant, namely S of AG equal S of A, and D of AG equal D of A. So this is gauge invariance. So that we have to treat separately when you integrate over this big space of gauge potential. We have to treat separately the integral of the gauge orbits that do not change the action and the integration into the transverse direction, which change the action. therefore will give rise to the quantum dynamics. So we have to choose a slice, a gauge slice. And such a choice of gauge slice is performed by performing a gauge fixing, enforcing a gauge fixing condition that I am going to denote in a very compact way, f of a equals 0, where f of a means, in fact, a set of local conditions enforced at each point in space-time. So for instance, it will be a condition like f a of a at point x. So I have a condition for each gauge field at each point x set to equal to 0. And for instance, f a of a at point x can be taken to be simply d mu of a mu a of x equals 0 in the case of the Lorentz gauge. Okay, so then how do we perform this calculation? First, I'm going to remark that hopefully for each A, somewhere in the space, there is a hopefully unique gauge transformation by a factor G naught that sends this A into an A naught that lives on the gauge slice. Okay. Well, F has to be built in such that, otherwise it's not a good gauge fixing condition. So, that's what I say. I say, for each A, there is an A naught, an A of G naught, which is G naught A G naught minus 1 plus I times G naught the derivative, the ordinary derivative of the inverse of G naught, such that F of A0, let us call this A0, G0 equals 0. Okay? And in A, I assume there is such a G0. And let me assume, in addition, that this G0 is unique. Warning, this is a non-trivial assumption. But basically, it means that I'm not choosing a gauge condition which do something like that. So that there are several solutions. But in fact, this is a very delicate point, which in general is not true, but in perturbation theory, so in the vicinity of A equals 0, that's true. That's important. So it's unique, at least. Vicinity in the topological sense of A equals 0, the ground state. So, yes?
The abstraction to this is the so-called pre-Bohmatic
gauges. Yes, but I won't talk about that. If you have such a problem, it's called, if you have several solutions, since it's called a Grybov. And that's an important aspect. But I'm not going to discuss that. Okay, so let me, this G naught, of course, is a function of A and of the gauge condition chosen. So let me denote this G naught. Gf of A, because it depends on A and on F, the gauge fixing condition. Okay. And so now let me rewrite my original path integral. Of A by adding to this path integral a factor 1. But I'm going to write 1 as, so this is an integral of my big A, this is an integral of my big gauge group transformation. I take the measure on G, where this is going to be the R measure. The measure that is invariant under multiplication to the left and to the right, times a delta function of G minus GF of A, where this is a Dirac delta function in the space of the group. It's a group invariant delta function. Okay. So at the moment I've done nothing. But the idea is to use the fact that use the gauge invariant to transform this into a constraint on A of G. Namely, to rewrite this as an. And in order to do that, what you do is to. There are many explanations in the lecture notes you have there, which means that you will get all the details, but I get lost. Okay, so this means that, so this is rather a delta of Gn, Gf minus A, because you cannot subtract two elements of the group. They are not in the group. So this is just the delta function that says that G is equal to Gf of A. Okay? And if you do that, you can just use the fact that in general, let me give a very simple example in one dimension. I have a variable x on the real axis. And I have a function f of x, which has the following form. Let us assume that it's a function like that, so that it has a unique point x naught, where f of x naught equals 0. Okay, and I want to write 1 exactly as I did here for this group function as integral over dx of delta of x minus x naught, x1. So I'm just picking the contribution of the point x1 by integrate over x. So I'd like to write this as integral dx delta function of f of x, 0. But if I do that, I have to take into account the fact that I'm making a change of variables from x to the f of x, that is a linear function close to x naught. And I have to use the fact that the delta of a times x is 1 over a times delta of x, if a is a constant. And moreover, in fact, if A is negative, it's a measure, so it's the absolute value of A. So I have to write this as absolute value of, so this means that I have to write this as delta of f of x times f prime of x. And I get f prime of x at x equal x naught because just this. So it just amounts to make the change of variables from x to f dx. That's just a formula of change of variables. Okay. Well, so that's a one-dimensional example. And here we are doing exactly the same thing. Instead of integrating over a single variable, we are integrating on G, that is an element of an infinite dimensional gauge group. But things come exactly the same. So we can rewrite Z, in fact, as a delta function of f of a of g. So we can rewrite this integral here as, let me go down. Integral d of g. A delta function in a big space of f of a of g. But if I am doing this, I have to take into account this determinant. So I have to write something that I'm going to write formally as the integral of a determinant. Well, if I'm doing going from one to two variables, and if I am enforcing two constraints, so I'm defining a function y1, it is a function y1 of x1 and x2, and y2 equal y2 of x1 and x2. And I have defining x10 and x20, the point in space where y1 equal y2 equal 0. I can rewrite integral over dx, which is a vector delta of x minus x0, as integral over dy. I can rewrite this as dx delta of y of x. This is a vector. But I have to write the absolute value of the determinant of the derivative dy divided by dx, where this is now a 2 by 2 matrix. It's a Jacobian, the Jacobian of the change of variable. So here I will have the determinant of a big object, which is the derivative of df over dg, some sense, at the point a of g. You see? Okay, and I'm going to define, and so I have the absolute value. So this is just this. So this is the absolute value of the of some determinants that I'm going to write. And once we have this, this depends on G. This depends on G. So we can make a change of variable. So in fact, this is, well, written like this, it depends on G. But in fact, this object, df, this object that I'm going determinant of df over dg of A of G is just a big matrix that I can call F prime of A of G. So it's a big matrix that depends on A of G. In some way. And therefore, you see, now you integrate, you have an integration over A of the action, exponential of the action, times an integral over G of a function of some big function of AG. This is a function of AG, and this is a function of AG. And using gauge invariance, I can change of variables and going from A to A equal A prime of A G, A of G, and make a change of integration to integral dG dA. Again, this has to be made, one has to be a bit careful because I explained exchanging integrations in functional integral may be dangerous, but let's do that. So if we do that, we can rewrite Z as integral over dG over the big group of local gauge transformation, integral over dA, okay? But now I'm changing into an integral over A prime. So you, first, you integrate over A, and you get the same thing. And now G is outside. For each G, I can make this change of variables that depends on G. So I get an integral over A prime, if you want. And then I have exponential of I times the action for S of A prime. And I can go from the first one to the other one because of gauge invariance. And here, I have made my change of variable, so I have delta of F of A prime times the absolute value of the determinant of this function F prime of A prime. But this is not the same A prime. Here it's an F prime because it's a matrix of derivative. And I used A prime because it was just another A, so let us call this A bar. Well, it's okay, let's keep it A. It's implicit, so it's an A. There is a matrix F prime of A. Okay. Is it clear? And you see that here, this factors out. So this is just the integral over with the R measure over the big gauge group. So it's just a volume. It's an infinite term because that's, we have a gauge group for each point. So it's something that is quite infinite. But that's basically the volume of the gauge group times this integral. Oh, and here we are integrating over A. I'm sorry, it's a big. Okay. So with this trick, which is due to Bryce DeWitt and Richard Feynman, I think, we have properly disentangled the integration over the gauge orbits and the integration over the gauge slice, because this is this integration over the gauge slice. Because there is the constraint, the gauge constraint, the gauge fixing constraint. This is the volume of the gauge orbits. But, and this is the term that takes into account the correct change of variables you have to take into account and the geometry of the configuration of the space of gauge configuration. Okay. So what is this determinant? that turns out to be, it will be called the Fadeyev Popov determinant. Popov determinant, usually, because it was also derived and made explicit by Fadeyev Popov determinant. So, what is this object that here looks like something very, very abstract? Okay. So, F prime of G is what I call F prime of A is the matrix of the partial derivative of F of A with respect to G, an element of the gauge group, when I make a gauge transformation over A, and that's the derivative close to the origin A, so that's when G is equal to 1. So it means that I take a gauge configuration, I make a small gauge transformation, I see how F changes, and I compute the determinant of this matrix of derivative. Okay? So now, what does it mean if, in terms of components, because remember, this is a very compact way to represent an infinite set of constraints. So I'm doing an infinitesimal constraint where alpha of x is an element of the group. It's an element, it's an element of the Lie algebra of the group. So it's a 2x2 Hermitian traceless matrix, which can be written as alpha A of x TA, where TA are the generators. So there are three different alpha A. Oh. Yes?
The fact that it's 2x2, is that because we're working in SU2?
That's because I'm going in SU2. Nice. Yes, but this formula is, that's the generator of the group. And that's one component of the gauge transformation. Okay? And so in fact, this means, in fact, a variation with respect to all the alpha b at any point, let's call it y, or space-time, of the sets of gauge configuration, but remember, each gauge constraint is a set of gauge constraints. You have one gauge constraint by generator, when I'm making a small gauge transformation, at a point x. You see, so in fact, this Jacobian, if you want, this Jacobian matrix, F prime, okay, is in fact the kernel. It's a big operator whose kernel is this. It's an F prime A B x and y. So we have a kernel of an operator acting on, so it has exponent, it has constraints, so it acts on the sets of functions from M onto the Lie algebra, on the adjoint representation, on functions. Let's call them chi A of x from space-time onto the Lie algebra of the group. So on vectors labeled by chi A. Okay. So we have a kernel of some complicated operator, which is not fundamentally different from the kernel of the operator that we have been considering in quantum field theory in the last week. It's something which turns out to be quite similar to the Hessian. Okay. And so this is of course an object that depends on the gauge configuration. Okay. And let us compute this object. So this is what I mean by f prime of A. Let us compute it for the in the case of the Lorentz gauge. That's a very general definition. But in the case of the Lorentz gauge, the Lorentz gauge is d mu with a mu upstairs of a mu a of x equals 0. And this is an ordinary derivative. That's not a covariant derivative. And under a gauge transformation, we have seen that a mu a of x changes into a mu a of x plus d mu alpha a of x. That's the ordinary gauge transformation term. But then there is a term that comes from the fact that the group is non-abelian, which is proportional to the commutator of alpha with A. And if I write it in term of component, I have the structure constant of the SU2 group, epsilon ABC, the totally antisymmetric tensor, times A mu B of X, times alpha C of x. Okay, so you see that there are two terms that depend on alpha, a term that involves an ordinary derivative, and a term that involves a mu. So now, what is this f prime for the Lorentz group? What is the Jacobian matrix? It's just the term of order alpha here. But here there is an operator. So that's the same rule than what we did last week when performing a pass integral quantization of phi to the 4 and renormalization. So what is f? So d mu of a mu a of x transform into d mu a mu a of x plus d mu up d mu down of alpha a of x plus epsilon a b c d mu of a mu b of x times alpha c of x. Okay? So this is the variation. This is delta f a of x. because this is FA of A of X in the case of Lorentz gauge. So we have to take the variation of this term with respect to alpha. So you see that here there is a Laplace operator, and here there is a derivative operator. So what we get is that, finally, this matrix, let me call it G rather than F prime. Well, that's not important. But in my notes, it's denoted G. So GAB of A, which is a function of A, which is what I denote F prime of A. But I'm going to look at the component AB. This is just a differential operator. Here there is a term which is just delta AB times the Laplace operator. Differential operator. Lambda equal d mu up d mu down. Yes? Pardon?
Lorentz signature.
Yeah, I'm using here. That's a calculation that doesn't depend on the signature.
Sure,
but okay. Because I have an index up and an index down. But you have to remember if the index is up, it's Lorentz. D mu up, as usual, is h mu nu d nu down. And if I'm using a Lorentz signature, this is a Lorentz tensor. I can do the same calculation for an Euclidean gauge theory, then it will be the ordinary identity tensor. Okay, but I'm writing the equation in covariant form, so that's we are on safe ground. Okay, so these terms give this term, that is ordinary. And now you see that these terms, it contains two terms. The derivative may act on A or it may act on alpha. So the terms where it acts of A is just epsilon A, B, C, D mu, A mu, B. So it's just a multiplication by a function. Okay? And then the D mu may act on the alpha, yes?
Should maybe that be a C?
No, there is an A mu, B here. I see the point. Yes. Rather write this as inverting mu B and C. Yes, you are right. You are perfectly right. Thank you. That was a typo in my notes. And then you get a term that is epsilon ABC A mu B times D mu, where the D mu acts on the right. Okay. So this is the operator. And we have to compute the contribution of the functional determinant of this operator. So you see, now we have to add to this. We have to add to this the determinant of this functional operator that depends on A. This is the contribution. Of the gauge fixing term. Okay, and you see that it is non-trivial for SU2 or any non-abelian gauge group because here you have the structure constant of the gauge group. And this term is not present for the U1 Maxwell theory. So So for the U1 Maxwell theory, this term is there in the calculation. But for most of the gauge, like the Lorentz gauge, it's just the determinant of an operator that does not depend on A. So you can factorize out and quantize naively by just fixing the gauge condition and making the calculations. It works for U1 because for U1 theory, it's independent of A mu A. But for G non-abelian, it is non-trivial. It depends on the, so it has to be taken into account in the quantization. If you are not taking into account this determinant in the functional integral by just enforcing the gauge constraint, you are not treating gauge invariance properly. And you run into a lot of problems. Okay. Good. So now we are going to make two assumptions according to Fadiev and Popov. First, one problem, we have the absolute value. Of the determinant. But you can realize very easily that the determinant, the sign of the determinant changes when you have some you go back in your space. It may change only through a point where this determinant vanishes, which means that one of the directions of your change of your gauge fixing is parallel to the gauge orbits. So if there is no Gribov ambiguities, the determinant is always has the same sign. And in A equals 0, it's just the Laplace operator, which has a determinant. Well, you have to take a minus if you want, but it has a definite sign, let's say plus. OK? So if no ambiguities, can forget about the absolute value and write this as an ordinary determinant. And so we end up with Z equal integral over D of A over my big space. Exponential of my action I S of A, the gauge action, the original gauge action, the constraint delta of F of A times this determinant of this matrix G of A, which is in fact defined in this way. Okay? Good. So now, how do we compute, and how can we perform perturbation theory? Well, this, you see, this is a definite operator plus a term that is proportional to A. And perturbation theory assumes that A is small, proportional to the coupling constants that were present here. So we can expand this determinant in A. And so there are perturbative rules. Okay, we can expand in A in powers A. This can be known for the determinant as well. Okay. And compute. Okay. But that's a bit tedious. And in fact, here comes the second trick. The second trick is to use Bérézin calculus that we used for fermions and represent this determinant as an integration over anti-commuting fields. Commuting variables. And that's the second beautiful trick that is, sometimes you can view it as a calculational trick, but it turns out that in fact there is something much deeper besides that that is related to some hidden supersymmetry. So these fields are called the ghost and anti-ghost fields of Fadiev and Popov. Okay. So the idea is that we have this determinant of a matrix G. And remember, we have seen that a determinant using the generals of can be written as an integral of over some anti-commuting variables. They were called theta and theta bar, but I'm going to call them C and C bar here because that's a standard denomination for gate theory of exponential of C bar GC. And, well, to make calculation consistent in the with the Lorentz signature, since there is an I in the action, I'm going to add a I here, but this means simply that I'm computing the determinant of IG. So there is an I factor that factors out. That's not very important. So let's see. Determinant of G is proportional to. So remember, G becomes of A. Okay? So, C and C bar are those ghost fields. And that's exactly the same calculation. I'm going to apply exactly the same rules. That's what we did for the quantization of the Dirac field. So you see, G now, G is a differential operator, exactly like the Dirac operator, ID slash minus M is a differential operator acting on some functions, and I want to compute the determinant of this Dirac operator. Here I want to compute the determinant of a differential operator that is not the Dirac operator, but an operator involving two derivatives. Okay. So, what are those C? C and C bar are functions, if you want, are Grassmann functions from M13, Minkowski space, onto the adjoint representation of the group G, ESU2, because this carries an index of the adjoint representation. So in fact, this means that C means a set of CA of X, where A goes for 1, 2, 3, for SU2, and X belongs to space-time. Same for C bar, which is a C bar A of X, is the same A, and this is the Grassmann conjugate. Of C, exactly like there was a theta and a theta bar. Okay, so you have a set of independent Grassmann numbers that are at each point, and you have three of them. Okay? And this object commutes, or anti-commutes. Okay, so this means that any anti-commutes. So there are Grassmann numbers, not ordinary numbers. So they generate a big Grassmann algebra. Okay? And so, what is this this action? So we have here something that I'm going to call the action S for the ghosts. So it depends on C bar, it depends on C, and it depends on A, because G contains A. So what is the action for the ghosts? So this, what I call C bar GC, which is the action for the ghosts. This is integral d4x. And I'm going to write it in coordinates. So this is C bar of x. This is this differential operator. And let me change, let me add the minus signs in order to have minus delta. So I can add a minus I if you prefer. So I will have a delta AB minus the Laplacian times plus times CB of X. And here it's a delta. Well, the C bar has an index in. So let me write this CB of X. And then there is an epsilon ABC d mu of C bar A of X. Well, I can write this in that way also by making a partial integration. A mu B of X CC of X. Okay, so this is the form of the ghost action. This is the form written with all the indices. And you can write it in a shorter way as d4 of x, I mean four dimension, I'm sorry, c bar minus the ordinary derivative times the covariant derivative that contains the dependence in mu. So this is a shorthand notation, and this is the notation with all the indices. Okay. And so, there is a kinetic term for the ghosts. So this is a kinetic term. And there is a term that describes the interaction, if you want, of the ghost with the gauge field. Because it contains two C, or a C bar, a C, and an A mu. So it's very much like the psi bar, A mu psi that you have in 3D, except that you have no Lorentz indices. So this means that in term, we have a new, so you can represent this term in terms of Feynman diagrams. Exactly like we did for that. But we have now a new field. We have the ghost field with a new propagator. We have a propagator for the ghosts that goes like that. And we have a new interaction vertex. Between the ghost and the anti-ghost. Okay? And in fact, the properties goes from C to the C bar. The C has a Grassmann conjugate. So the ghosts are complex numbers. Okay? So, and they carry indices. So the ghost, the propagator, can be represented as an arrow like that. So the ghosts. Carry charges. Exactly like the same kind of charge than the gauge bosons. That's why they interact with the gauge boson. There are ghosts, well, okay, there are ghosts in the sense that they are anti-commuting variable. So they are fermions. the ghosts are fermions. They obey the Fermi-Dirac statistics, not the Bose-Einstein statistics. Okay? But the ghosts are scalars, not spinors, because they carry no Lorentz indices. They have spin zero. So they are spin zero fermions, charge spin zero fermions, which is very bad, because it means that they violate spin statistic theorem. The theorem that tells you that particles with integer spins are bosons and particles with half integer spins are fermions. Okay. Well, but the hypothesis that underlies the spin statistic theorem is unitarity. Lorentz invariance plus unitarity. So this action is Lorentz invariance, no problem. So what the ghost violates is unitarity. If you try to build out in a canonical formalism an theory with Hilbert space, et cetera, for the ghost, you discover that the scalar products of ghost states are negative. It's not an Hilbert space. It's, I don't know how it's called, a generalized Hilbert space. Okay. So that's because no unitarity. But in fact, that's what we, the theoreticians in the 60s, were looking for. Because if you don't take this into account, you discover that you quantize naively gauge theories, they violate unitarity. And the ghosts are precisely there to represent the terms that compensate for those violations of unitarity. And I'm going to show that a bit later. OK, so that's OK, because ghost plus the gauge field turns out to make a perfectly unitary theory. OK? And that's the reason why they have been called ghosts, I think, by Fadeyev and Popov, because they are not some ordinary particles. And you cannot observe ghosts in any physical process. They are there in the functional integral and in the theory to represent in a proper way the real interactions between the particles, and you can never create ghosts out of a physical particle, because otherwise it would mean that the quantum physics violates unitarity, which means that we have negative probabilities larger than one, which is problematic. Okay. Yes?
Before you said that the ghosts carry the charge of another field, but the AMUs are uncharged.
No, the AMU carry a charge because that's an AMUB, so they have spin one and a charge. Okay. And the ghosts carry a charge because they are labeled by some, they carry some Cope indices, but they carry no spin.
So in the Feynman diagram you've got there, what's the squiggly line? Is that the, I thought that was the A.
What's the vertex here, you mean?
No, there's the line that goes up from the vertex.
Yeah.
What is the...
I'm going to write it, yes. Oh. I'm just going to write it. I just wanted to show you what we have. So now, I'm going to show you what are the real Feynman rules, because I was very, very sketchy here. And that will be needed for the discussion of renormalization. So I'm not going to make any real calculation because it starts to be quite long. But you can find the detail, for instance, in the book by Peshkin and Schroeder, where all the details of the one-loop calculation are given. But I want to give you some flavor of what's going on. So we have this problem. OK, so let me just use. So front is bad. This one. Okay, so finally, there is a little subtle point that I forgot to mention about the propagator. So now, with those rules, what are the Feynman rules? Once the gauge fixing has been performed. So first, where is the okay, yes. One point remains to be done. It's what is the propagator for the gauge field? So let me write the gauge field propagator. A propagator. So I'm using the gauge, the Lorentz gauge. So in fact, what I'm going to compute is I want to compute what is the form of the action when I have an integral of a dA. I have an exponential of minus of I times integral d4x, and I have a 1 over g squared. I have 1 over 2 g squared. I'm sorry, 2 g squared, 4 g squared, sorry. Integral d4x. And I add a d mu a nu minus d nu a mu a times squared. That's just the linear part. And I have the constraint that delta of d mu a mu equals 0. That's what gives you the propagator. So in fact, you can use an extension of the Lorentz gauge that is due to Feynman, that is just that you enforce that d mu a mu is equal to some epsilon mu of x, where epsilon mu of x is just a given function. Okay. And the final result should not depend on epsilon, because remember, changing the gauge slice should not depend. Yes?
Epsilon shouldn't have any index.
Pardon?
Epsilon didn't have any index.
It has?
It's just a scalar function.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a scalar function. Yes, sorry. So it's an epsilon A. Yeah, thank you very much. That's a typo. Okay? So you can replace this by minus epsilon A of x without changing the things. And in addition, since it doesn't depend on epsilon of A, you may, in your path integral, integrate over values a with some weight. Okay, so you can write and add an expression of minus I over some two times some factor that I'm going to call chi d4x epsilon a of x epsilon a of x. Okay, so this means that I'm going to say that d mu a mu of x is fixed, but with something that can vary a little bit around epsilon a equals 0. Okay, and then it's trivial to, and of course, and then you integrate over d epsilon. So I am adding a path integral over epsilon. But since epsilon is purely local, you see that it amounts to change the action into to add to the action a term that is proportional to chi times the square of this object. Okay. So you get something which is exponential of I 1 over 4 g squared times d mu a nu a minus d nu a mu a squared plus more or less psi d mu a mu a squared. Okay. And this is invertible. That's it. This was not invertible. Because now we have to invert. So the matrix element is dAB mu nu of P in momentum space, which will be delta AB times minus P nu plus P squared H mu nu, or we indices it back, H mu nu, which is not invertible. We have seen that this is not invertible because of gauge invariance. But once you had these terms, you get something like an additional P mu, H mu nu. You get an additional term like that, which leaves the degeneracy. So this is invertible. Okay? Yes?
What is psi here?
What is?
Psi.
It's just a number, parameter.
Do
so we have any restrictions? So this Feynman gauge, in fact, depends on a parameter chi, and the physics should not depend on chi. So in particular, if you set chi equals 0, this is the original Lorentz gauge. But that's an additional parameter you can use, for instance, for some calculation. It's better, and you can check gauge invariance. Yes?
Yeah. Should that be P squared times H mu?
No, because this term is an A mu D mu times an A nu D nu. This is D mu A mu squared.
Yeah.
So it's a P mu P nu. Okay? Okay, anyway, that's a technical point. So it's not as important as the result. The important point is that now the AA propagator which depends on spin indices, so Lorentz indices and Schwarz indices, is in momentum space, this is delta AB, this minus I over K squared minus I, this is K, momentum here, K squared minus I epsilon plus. So that's the usual propagator for a scalar field. But then we have H mu nu plus chi minus 1 K mu K nu over K squared. So this is a propagator for the gauge field. So now, what is the propagator for the ghosts? The propagator for the ghost, so I'm going to represent ghost as usual by a dashed line because it means that they are ghosty. So this is a propagator that gives you the CA, C bar B. So this is A mu A nu B contained in the free theory at G equals 0, contained for the free theory at G equals 0. And remember, they anti-commute, so they have to, you have to specify what is the order. Okay, and well, it is just given by the terms delta AB minus Laplacian. So this is simply delta AB times the propagator of the scalar particles k squared minus I epsilon plus. Okay? Because the ghosts are spinless particles. But the fact that the anticommutes will come out only in the fact that when you compute internal loops and you have a loop of ghosts, there will be a minus sign coming from the Fermi-Dirac statistics instead of the plus sign coming from the boson statistics. Okay, so now, of course, I cannot use this blackboard. So let me perhaps just so either I use this. No, let me. I prefer to erase. Now, what about the interactions? So these are the propagators. Okay. And of course, you are going to have a propagator for the Dirac field or for the, if you have. But what are the vertices? Interaction vertices. But I wrote them very, very schematically yesterday. Interaction vertices. First, remember the action. S of gauge field contained three terms because it was it contains an F mu nu squared. Well, F mu nu is d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus factor I or minus I, don't remember, the commutator a mu of a nu, which means that you have interactions between, you may have, and you have the test square of that, so you have, you may have a Strigluon, a Strigley gauge field. So why am I calling this gluon? Okay, let us say three gauge field. Gluon are the name of the gauge fields for the SU3 strong interaction model. Three gauge field, they carry moment, so they carry moment, so they carry Lorentz indices, momenta, and charges. Well, let me write the momenta p, q, k, p, and q. Let me note the momenta a mu, b, and nu for the Lorentz and color and gauge field indices. So this is rho. This is c. So these are Lorentz indices. And these are gauge field indices. Of course, I have that the momenta k plus p plus q equals 0. And this term is proportional to g, coupling constant. And there is an, if you want to be careful, there is an epsilon abc. That's the structure constant of the group. So you have only, for instance, for SU2, a gauge field with gauge index A may interact only with 2 and 3, not with itself. And you have then a factor that depends on the spin that is a bit complicated, but that comes out just from the calculation. And you find that this is H mu nu k minus P rho plus H nu rho oh, I'm sorry, there is a big, there is a typo here. This is P minus Q mu plus H rho mu Q minus K nu. There is a typo in the notes that are online. So you see that it's perfectly symmetric. And you see that this vertex contains a dependence in the momenta. So it's not a phi cube interaction. It's a square dA interaction. So it has to depends on the momentum. Okay. So now we have a four-gauge vertex. That comes just for the square of the commutator. And again, if I am writing A mu B nu C rho and and D and sigma, the group and Lorentz indices. This doesn't depend on the momenta, so I'm not going to write the momenta. At the factor, and there is a minus I G squared. I am in a Lorentzian signature, so there is an I factor coming from the I in the action. Now, I have an epsilon A, B, C, epsilon C D E times H mu rho H nu sigma minus H mu sigma H mu rho. Okay, so it comes from the fact where mu and rho and nu and sigma. So you have to take into account the different contribution of the spin. And this, you have to make this symmetric. So you have this plus epsilon A C E epsilon B D E H mu nu H rho sigma minus H mu sigma H nu rho plus epsilon A D E epsilon B C E times H nu nu H rho sigma minus H mu rho H nu sigma. Okay, so this is symmetric. And you may notice that there is in fact an with sum over some as this ABE, I'm sorry, with sum over an intermediate index with sum over it. So there's some kind of intermediate index, but of course that's the general formula. You have some for a group with an FABC structure constant, but for SU2, you have that epsilon ABE epsilon CDE is nothing but delta AC delta BD minus delta AD delta BC. So in fact, this is it. So this means that, for example, this term represents the fact when you have two color index A and B that comes out that way, and they come out unchanged. So you see some law of conservation of the charge here. But here, there is a law of interchange of charges. If you have a charge 1 here, it can only become a pair of charge 2 and 3. Okay, so that's for the gauge. So these are the vertices, the correct symmetry factor. And now, of course, we have the very important last term. Yes?
It's between the second and third lines.
Yes?
So on the second line, you have H mu nu H rho sigma. And on the third line, you have
H mu.
H mu H rho sigma.
And H mu sigma H nu rho. Yes?
Oh, but on the third line, the first term, you have
H mu nu H rho sigma.
Is that correct? Or not?
Oh, that's still again a misprint. Again a typo. Sorry. I thought that the latest version, so it's, well, it should be H mu sigma H rho nu minus H mu nu H rho sigma or something like that. Okay, anyway, you just, these are the three permutations. You take two pairs and you make of legs and you make the permutation. So I'm sorry, thank you. I didn't pay attention to that. Okay, so that's the three gauge. And finally, there is an very important interaction vertex that comes out from the fact that the action of the ghost involves a coupling between the ghost and the gauge field. So you have a ghost gauge interaction vertex that looks very much, as I said, as the interaction vertex between a photon and an electron fermion in a trick. But then there is a factor minus G. There is a factor epsilon ABC. That's the only thing you can build out of the gauge theory. So you have the structure, the structure constant that tells you the relation between the charges of the incoming ghost, the outcoming ghost, and the gauge boson. And there is a d mu, which means that there is a derivative. So there is a dependence in the momenta. And it turns out that this dependence in the momenta is p mu, where p is the outgoing momenta of the ghost. Okay, with my choice of writing as the action. So there is a dependence in the momenta, but of course, p is equal to this momenta plus this momenta. So it means that it depends on the momentum of the incoming ghost plus the momenta of the incoming gauge boson. Okay. Good. So now, well, that's it. These are the Feynman rules of a non-abelian gauge theory. And in addition to that, if you have matter, if you have matter fields, we have to add the ordinary vertices between matter and gauge bosons. Remember, if we have scalars, if we have Dirac fermions, we have a propagator for Dirac fermions and an interaction vertex, which are exactly the same than for QED. It's just group factor, and we have a scalar. Well, it has a charge. Now they carry charge. And you have two kinds of interaction vertices, an interaction vertex like that, and an interaction vertex involving two gauge bosons. Okay, and importantly, there are, of course, no interaction, no direct interaction between the matter and the ghosts. The ghosts are there, just there to make the dynamics of the gauge field consistent. If there were interaction between matter and ghosts, it would be a disaster. Okay. Well, These are the rules with a detail factor up to still a few misprints that I have to correct. And finally, so this is the front. I'm not going to discuss to start to discuss renormalization. It's too late, but let me just make a few remarks about why we need ghosts and why we need to define a consistent gate series. Yes, I have 5 minutes, so I can just make some trivial remarks. Yes, so, okay, so let me just remark something about the existence of physical and unphysical states in a gauge series. Okay? And the consideration I'm going to explain here, that's explained in standard books, nothing original about it, applies as well to quantum electrodynamics. It applies to the fact that if we have a vector massless particle, namely a particle with a spin one. Okay, it is described by a vector a mu, or if you want a mu of k in momentum space, which takes as a general forms some ei. So it's a momentum. So if you want exponential, you can write this as ei kx times some epsilon mu vector, where this is called the polarization vector. It has four independent components, which means the direction in which the gauge potential lives and oscillates with the position in space of time. Okay. So there are four in general, since mu goes from 1 to 4 in four dimensions, there are four possible polarization states in series. Okay. Well, it is known that the photon has only two polarization states that are physical that we can observe. So if you have a photon that propagates like that, or a plane wave, that's classical optics. The electric field can oscillate like that, or it can oscillate like that when the photon moves like that, the electromagnetic wave. That's just pure Maxwell theory, solving the Maxwell equation. So those polarizations are called transverse polarization. And that's because a photon, the vector of a photon is of the form K naught and K, with, and of course, K squared equals zero because the photon is massless, which means that K naught equals the modulus of the momentum of the photon. The energy is equal to the momentum. Okay. And those two polarization, transverse polarization, let us call it epsilon 1 transverse and epsilon 2 transverse, are of the form epsilon 1 transverse. So let us assume that K is, if K is K naught 0, 0, then epsilon transverse 1 is 0, 0, 1, 0, and epsilon transverse 2 equals 0, 0, 0, 1. Okay, it corresponds to having a photon moment with a momentum k in space, and you have epsilon 1 and epsilon epsilon 2. Okay. So, and making a linear combination of that, you can, for example, circularize polarized light. So this is linearly polarized light, and making linear combination, you get circular polarized light, etc., or any polarization state you may have. Okay. So now, of course, there are two others. Polarizations. There is one which is, and let me call it epsilon plus, which is 1, 1, 0, 0, that is a longitudinal. So the electromagnetic field is in the same direction that K. So it means there is a vector potential and a gauge potential that are in the direction. And you have epsilon minus, which is 1, minus 1, 0, 0. And these are light-like polarization, because those epsilon plus squared equals epsilon minus squared equals 0. While these are non-zero. Okay, and this is also called or forward polarization, and this is called the backward polarization, because it's a polarization that goes in the same direction than K, and this goes in the other direction. Okay. And those are unphysical because if you want to compute, for instance, the propagator of such a gauge polarization using the propagator we had here, you discover that they propagate with negative probability of that. So they are unphysical because they are problematic with unitarity. You can say also that this there is a 1 over k squared. So anyway, they are problematic. OK, so the question is, these possible states, why do they not appear in the physics? Why do we never observe them? Well, in QED, we never observe them because they do not couple to matter. And the question, the difficult question in non-abelian gauge theories is, to be sure that if you have a process where you send some, for instance, a physical state, an epsilon physical here, physical polarization state, you cannot have unphysical states. We don't want that. No. We don't want that. And it's gauge invariance, if properly treated, that will forbid such process, that when you compute such process, you may have in between some virtual process with virtual particles that belong to this set of unphysical states, but they should not come out. It's like negative energy states can be virtual intermediate states, but they cannot be. Okay. And that's the key point to the proof of renormalization of gauge theory. The problem is that when you want to renormalize gauge theory, we want to be sure that those unphysical states, polarization states, keeps away from the state that we can observe. And that's what I'm going to discuss tomorrow in a sketchy way. Okay, thank you.